is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Actually getting the player to say yes to your program, especially if he's a high major or high major plus player, and you have a lot of other real dudes at other real staffs chasing the family and the kid down the same way you are, that's by far the hardest thing to do. So it's an art. It's a moving target. We can't say we have it perfect by any means. We have a system that works for us. And if you can get a kid that you really like to sign a letter of intent after a 2.5-year recruiting process, that's a big-time accomplishment.
Lyle Wolf is entering his fourth season as a men's basketball assistant coach at Texas A&M University. Wolf has spent the past 10 seasons with Coach Buzz Williams at Virginia Tech and Marquette. Lyle was Virginia Tech's director of men's basketball operations and previously served as the assistant to the head coach and director of student-athlete development. Wolf began his collegiate coaching career as a graduate assistant at Marquette. He assisted in the day-to-day operations of the program and supervised the team's managerial staff before obtaining a master's degree in sports leadership in the spring of 2014. Lyle graduated from Transylvania University in 2010 with a degree in business administration, where he was a member of the basketball team in 2006-2007. Following graduation, Wolf served as the junior varsity basketball coach at Sayre School. Wolf earned his doctorate of education in global sports leadership from East Tennessee State in March of 2018. Hey Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hey, this is Tuck Taylor with NeuroBeast, and you're listening to Hoopheads Podcast.
If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why FastModel Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, FastModel is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. FastModel also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. FastModel Sports is the best in basketball. Grab your notebook as you listen to this episode with Lyle Wolf, men's basketball assistant coach at Texas A&M University. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkle tonight, and we are pleased to welcome from Texas A&M University the men's assistant basketball coach Lyle Wolf. Lyle, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
I appreciate you guys having me. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. We're excited to be able to have you on and dive into all the things that you've been able to do in your career and what you guys are continuing to build there at Texas A&M with Coach Williams. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of your earliest memories of the game of basketball.
Well, I appreciate that. I grew up in Lexington, Kentucky, so I grew up watching Kentucky basketball. So as many listeners know, it's definitely a high level of basketball. So I was always a basketball fan, grew up playing. Then played a little in high school, mainly played football in high school. And then I went to Transylvania University, which is in Lexington, and I had the opportunity to play for a very good basketball coach and a good human being. His name is Brian Lane, the current head coach at Transy. And I played for him for a year, and I loved it. I ended up not playing anymore. I was not a good athlete or a good basketball player, but I still enjoyed the game, enjoyed watching. So I did graduate from Transy, and then I got really, really lucky on kind of how I got into coaching. Kind of followed my mom and my dad's advice on kind of following a passion in life, and not to get too long-winded, but at the end of the day, I had a kind of a boring 8-to-5 job. I was working as a middle school basketball coach, and the following summer, I ended up working a whole bunch of summer camps, got kind of the itch to get into coaching, and sure enough, a year later, was fortunate enough to join Coach Williams at Marquette as a graduate assistant. So I got extremely lucky at the right time.
So when you went to college, did you know that coaching was something that you wanted to do? Were you thinking teaching and coaching, or was it something more that just kind of snuck up on you?
Yeah, not at the moment. I was getting a degree in finance just because numbers necessarily didn't scare me, and I thought I was going to get into business. And like most college kids, I kind of had an idea on at least a subject that interests me, but had no idea what I was going to do with it the second that you graduate. So I was kind of just, you know, typical college kid hanging out with friends, you know, doing what college kids do. And no, I did not have the realization or the desire or the impulse to get into coaching until about 6 months after I graduated. Once I figured out I couldn't sit behind a desk and kind of work spreadsheets. So that's kind of when the desire kicked in.
So what was that first coaching experience like for you? Was it something that right away when you started, you were like, oh man, I could see myself doing this. This is something I should consider. Or was it more of a slow growth?
Yeah. So I would say I had a lot of excitement. So it was actually a seventh grade middle school team. And so as all seventh graders do, they have organic energy to listen and to learn. And, you know, if you say, hey, I want you to dribble 10 times and spin around on your head, they actually would attempt it, you know? So like there was a lot of joy that first year of coaching and kind of getting after it and messing around with different concepts. So I do remember that first year. I was like, yeah, I could definitely get into this. I have a lot to learn. I was kind of understanding, you know, my communication style, their listening and their communication style as well. So it was definitely a little bit of a jump into the deep end method. Ted Hall, who's a very good high school coach in Lexington, Kentucky, gave me the opportunity, and he gave me a lot of structure and a lot of guidance and has been a great mentor in my life. But that first year, it definitely gave the excitement. It kind of started the fire, and then obviously it's built from there.
What was something that you were good at right out of the gate, and what's something that you look back now and you're like, man, I was really bad at that?
I was really bad at coaching basketball in seventh grade. You know, like it's funny. I look back, and at the time I was like, okay, I'm doing all the right stuff. And if I had to talk to myself where I am now to back then, I did a terrible job. But I've even said that about myself over the last 16 months too, you know? So a good thing is that means there's been some degree of growth. But I would say at the time, we did a really good job, at least in seventh grade, of keeping it fun. You know, heck, we put an out of bounds play one time in when we were losing by 40 with about 2 minutes left, and get in your typical stack alignment, four guys, and we had three guys dive to the corner just to everybody visually distract them, and the other guy went back door and dropped it to him and laid it up. And so just kind of fun stuff like that. But no, there was definitely a lot looking back that I could have improved or done a better job with, for sure.
As you were going through that and you're in the middle school, was the thinking that, hey, I'm going to continue to hopefully progress and stay with this and kind of stay at the high school level? Or was when you went to the camps over the summer, was the idea that, hey, maybe I want to try to coach at a higher level? Just what was the thinking when you went out to camp? Was it going to be for fun? Was it career advancement? Just where was your mindset when you left that summer to go and work those various camps that you did?
So about mid-fall of, I guess it was 2011, I recognized that, maybe it was 10. Yeah, fall of 2010, I recognized I didn't want to do that finance job anymore. So I got into coaching, middle school coaching, et cetera. But then I was like, okay, I want to do this at the college level. I think I'd have interest in doing that. So what is available? Like, what could I do? Obviously, being an assistant is not realistic. So within the research, I found out something called a graduate assistant position, which at the time I didn't even know existed. So like a typical naive, I don't know what I don't know individual, I sent a whole bunch of emails out, all Division I. I don't think I sent any to Division II. I probably sent 300 emails and just said, hey, I want to be a graduate assistant. Do you have anything available? More or less, can I have it? Like that was a dumb question. So thankfully, a lot of people did not respond. A few people did say, I apologize. You know, we don't have anything coming. But one individual, his name is Brad Autry, and he's a very close friend of mine and a mentor as well. He was more or less the director of operations at Marquette. And he responded saying, hey, your intent is right, but you're going about it the wrong way. You need to build relationships. You need to meet as many people as possible. You need to outwork everybody that's doing it. There's millions of people emailing every single day, and you have to stand out. And so I'm extremely thankful for that email, because I responded saying, okay, more or less I said, okay, thank you. Can I work your camp? Because he said, work a whole bunch of camps, get to know people. So thankfully, because of that email, that led to, okay, I need to set up a whole bunch of summer camps. I need to try to do them back to back to back to back. And so that kind of kickstarted the whole, okay, this is the thought process on how to run down a graduate assistant position. So the following summer, I worked Transy. I drove from Lexington all the way down to Waco. I worked Baylor's camp. When that finished, I drove from Waco to Minneapolis, worked Minnesota's camp, drove from Minneapolis to Milwaukee, worked Marquette's camp, had like a week or two off. And because I did a halfway decent job, went back to work a second camp at Marquette, and I canceled. I think I had scheduled camp at Syracuse. But no, the camp gauntlet was because of that email saying, hey, if you want to be a GA, you need to go meet a whole bunch of people, build your network, and outwork everybody.
So then what did that look like day to day for you at camp as you're thinking about, hey, I want to try to build relationships. I want to make sure that I'm working hard, that I'm impressing anybody who may or may not be watching me there while I'm at camp. Just talk a little bit about what your mindset was or how you tried to approach each day. Because we've all seen coaches, no matter what camps you work, there's guys that are into it and guys that are doing than their fair share. And then conversely, there's guys that aren't. So just talk a little bit about where your mindset was at that point.
So I definitely think it was a moving target for me. By no means did I walk in knowing that I'm going to be the best. I think thankfully I've had good influences in my life with my family and, you know, different mentors kind of feeding me the right stuff. But ultimately, you know, showing up extremely early, always offering, hey, is there anything else I can do? Not having my backpack on, not having headphones in, putting my phone away, having really, really good energy with kids. And again, some of this I didn't really know day one when I walked in, but I just kind of picked up on it based on, hey, that guy looks like he's doing a really good job. Like, how can I mimic that? But mainly just spending the energy and the effort and kind of doing the little stuff and doing extra. And again, I was given that advice when you know chat with different people on how to go out and capture an opportunity, not necessarily just kind of wait for one. But I got lucky and I was blessed that the director of ops at the time at Marquette kind of recognized the effort I was putting in. And there's a lot of really good guys that worked camp with me, so it wasn't like I was the only one doing well and everybody else stunk. That wasn't the case. You know, I think there's a significant degree of luck that plays into everybody's life. And so I think I was lucky enough to have that opportunity when it came.
What was that conversation like after the fact when the opportunity comes your way at Marquette? Do you reach out to them? Are they reaching out to you after dealing with you at camp and having you around? Or just what was the process like to get you there?
So I knew that the current graduate assistant at that time only had 1 year left. So when I was working summer camps, I knew that he was going into his second year. So I knew that they would be hiring for a GA the following summer. So that GA knew my interest. The director of basketball operations knew my interest. I had met majority of the staff. I had met Coach Williams once, but that was kind of it. So mainly all the support staff knew that I wanted the position. So I stayed in contact with them throughout the entire year. I took the advice of a lot of people, and I wrote Coach Williams on a monthly basis. I think I met and saw Marquette play Cincinnati one year at Cincinnati just to stay connected. And again, all that was advice that was given to me by Brad Autry at the time. And then actually receiving the position that year later when that current graduate assistant was leaving, Brad Autry said, hey, why don't you just come early, help set up camp. If it wasn't for Brad Autry, I would not have that GA job. Hey, come early, help set up for this camp, be around, et cetera. And so there was a couple of conversations randomly with Coach Williams, kind of asking different things just to kind of have a better pulse on who I am and my character, et cetera. Because he's the head coach. He's not supposed to have that sort of daily interaction with somebody who's not in the program at that time. And so it was kind of funny. A lot as the conversations were building, as the interest from both parties were continuing, one of the first questions he asked me is, hey, you graduated from Transylvania? And I said, yes, sir. He said, is that a real school or one of those made-up schools? I was like, yeah, that's a good question. It is a real school. So it was kind of funny. But it actually happened very quickly. It was literally in a two-day window. I was kind of getting a pulse that I have a chance at it. And thankfully, I had made friends and built relationships with everybody on the support staff, the GAs, the managers, and kind of everybody was kind of putting their vote in for me as that GA. And then Coach Williams had a pretty short conversations with me. Hey, this is my expectation level. These are the things you can't do to get the program in trouble. Be the first one to arrive, the last one to leave, and you start tomorrow. So it was a very surreal moment. I kind of remember being extremely overwhelmed emotionally for about 10 minutes after that, after I called my folks, because that was the first time I ever like chased something down. And it was good. It was, I had no idea it would turn into this, but I've been very fortunate.
So you get the job and now you got to move. And I know you had a huge salary as a graduate assistant that you could just have your pick of whatever kind of housing you wanted. You could live wherever, whatever community you decide to do. So just talk a little about the process of sort of upending your life and what you remember about that.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of sacrifices. I was dating a girl pretty seriously at the time in Lexington, and so I had to say, hey, I'm chasing this dream of mine, and you know, she didn't want me to leave, so that was unique for whatever, however old I was, 21, 22, and so I did do that, and you know, moving away from Kentucky for the first time ever, I think potentially can be exciting for most and can be nervous for others, but I kind of had a lot of adrenaline at the time, so I actually didn't think anything of it. I pretty much stayed there majority of the summer, came back, packed my stuff up in like a 3 or 4 day window, and really I didn't bring anything. I stayed in the dorms where our players stayed at Marquette, so the furniture wise everything was there. So honestly, I don't know how much I brought, if anything, but a handful of bags, you know, maybe a mattress, and then you know you're going to spend 80 to 85% of your hours at the facility. So from a packing standpoint, there wasn't a lot. It was unique, you know, saying bye to family, but because you're excited about the passion and the dream that you're chasing, it wasn't like a homesickness window or anything like that. So you kind of hit the ground running, you know, go back. I did have to apply to get into grad school. I was already in, thankfully that was good advice from Brad Autry. I was already in grad school, went back, packed my stuff. I came back about a week before the players came back in the fall and hit the ground running kind of full speed.
So how did you balance going to school and getting your graduate degree with the responsibilities that you had with the team? So talk a little bit about making that equation work, and then also maybe add in what you did day to day. I'm sure there was a bazillion things, but just what you remember about some of the tasks that you did in that first year.
So I definitely, for me, but I was not married and I was 23 probably, or 24 at the time. So being not married, 24. So I could work the long hours. I could stay up late studying for my master's. Like there was all that. So, you know, I want to say, and at the time I just muscled through it, allocated time, stay up late, crammed in papers, like found a way to make it work. And I definitely know as you get older and you have family and kids, it's not as applicable. But at least at that time, I had the flexibility with no other dependents, no other responsibilities besides being a really good graduate assistant and making sure that I have good grades. And so from the how to manage both, you just have to make it work. You pretty much wake up really early, you go to bed really late, and then do it again. But heck, at all of us at 24, we could easily pull that off. And then from a responsibility standpoint, I think being a graduate assistant is different based on which program you're in or which school you go to. For me, I was a little bit more of Coach Williams' right-hand man. Not just myself because it was me, but any GA for Coach Williams, that's kind of who you are. So you're helping him with anything that he needs. I mean, I've done a laundry list of personal things from getting his car clean to helping him with some dry cleaning to helping getting his kids from A to B to then on court as well, where I have a pad out there kind of pushing players around and I'm helping players make sure they get going. You know, do they make it to class okay? Are they in study hall? If they're running late because an individual workout ran late, you know, how can I help expedite that process? When there's guests that come in and they need a tour, I'm that person. I'm helping doing laundry. I'm helping manage the managers. So you're kind of a catch-all in a lot of different things, but it's funny. It's at least within our program, you're definitely a gopher and you're definitely a pack mule. So I learned to carry a lot of different bags at once. And I also learned to get things done in a very fast manner.
In addition to doing those types of tasks, obviously one of the things that as you're going through this process, you're trying to learn, you're trying to improve yourself as a coach with the idea that eventually you're going to be able to advance and be able to do more things out on the floor, get more involved with the X's and O's, get more involved with coaching on the floor. So in those first couple of years, what were you doing? Obviously, you're trying to absorb as much as you can from Coach Williams and the staff and the guys that you're working with on a day-to-day basis. But what else did you do to be able to increase your knowledge of the game? Are you reading? Are you watching film? Are you talking to mentors? Some combination of all those things. Just where was your growth coming from at that point in your career?
So definitely a lot of it was just kind of being a fly on the wall, or I guess it was an interactive fly on the wall in the gym. So during practices, and what is Coach Williams saying when he stops practice? What is Coach Autry saying when he stops practice? You know, what was Coach Jerry Wainwright saying when he stopped practice? So there was definitely a lot to be learned in the actual practice segment. And then in addition to that, I definitely worked hand in hand with a lot of the assistants on the scouting reports. So whether it's watching personnel and typing the tendencies, or, you know, even Jeff Reynolds is a former head coach and a good friend of our program and mine, you know, he did a lot of the scouts. And so he's a little bit old school. He would do a lot of handwritten stuff. And so I would type out his notes to make it electronic. And so there was a lot that I learned just on his own film evaluations, just by strictly being the person that typed up his handwritten notes. So there was a lot that I learned just because I was a part of some degree of the process with assistant coaches and support staff in the basketball decisions. Now, I was thankful enough that Coach Williams and the staff allowed me to sit in on like coaching staff meetings. And so as they talk basketball, I'm just writing stuff down, listening, trying to retain. Typically would not ask questions in that setting. You know, you kind of have to be, you know, I think there's a phrase and I'm going to blank on the right way of saying it, but like even managers and GAs, you know, you want your presence to be known, but you don't want your voice to be heard, or something along those lines. So, you know, you're kind of there in support, but you're listening to as much as you can. So I would say those are your 80% of how I learned is just kind of through the process. And then 20% is, yeah, you're definitely, you know, you're looking at Pick and Pop, which was a popular site at the time. Podcasts were not as interactive as they are now, but you're just looking for resources to learn. So a lot of articles. Coach Williams is a big time reader and he would pass along a lot of articles to the staff as well. So I learned a lot in that regard as well.
Did you and do you currently have a way to catalog the notes that you might be taking or the articles that you come across, or now obviously with video and that kind of thing. Do you have a formal system for how you kind of keep track of things?
It's so funny. Our staff almost argues about this because you can find like the best system for you, and all of a sudden something else comes around and you're like, oh shoot, that might be better. So when it comes to like paper or actual content, I currently use, and so does TJ Ryan, who's our video coordinator, who's an very intelligent individual, both on the court and off the court. We both use Notability. But Notability is just another form of all the different apps out there that you can use to help organize things. So I believe Coach Williams uses not Keynote, but whatever the Mac version of organization one is. OneNote, sorry. He uses OneNote.
Gotcha. Okay.
And so, we use Notability. He uses OneNote. Other than that, I would say everything is kind of on an external. And I would say that's pretty much it. There's not one spot that has both video and non-video content. But if it's a non-video content, it's probably on Notability.
Got it. Yeah, it's interesting just talking to different people, how they go about organizing that. Because anyone who's in the coaching profession, obviously you're always being exposed to new ideas and new thoughts. And one of the things that we found with the podcast, a number of coaches that are constantly, as you said, with Coach Williams or yourself, you're constantly reading, you're constantly looking for things.
Yes.
And it's so easy to come across it and you're just sitting there reading it. You're like, oh, this is a great idea. Or, wow, I'd really like to incorporate that, or whatever it may be, whether it's leadership or it's X's and O's or whatever it, you know, whatever it is that you're looking at. And yet you got to have a system because it's really easy for that stuff to get lost. So I'm always curious when I talk to coaches, hey, how do you go about doing that? And everybody seems to have a slightly different way, as you said, and you got to find what works for you without question.
I think you're right on that. And I think it's hard too. If somebody can figure out how to like make all systems like the same, like for example, you can go through Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok, and you can save all the stuff you want to save. But is there a way to like streamline that all into one spot? There's currently not. So I think somebody can make some money that way if they can figure
it out. That's a good idea. I wish I was a tech guy, because that's a really good idea. I like it, because yeah,
Mike's going to start a new. Mike's going to start a new venture now. Way to go, Lyle! Good job.
There's some money to be made.
There is, although I don't think I have the expertise. I'd have to be the general idea guy and get somebody who could do some technical stuff. But that's interesting, because again, there's just so much stuff out there, and you can easily just compile a ton of it. And I can't remember why I read this, but just somebody talked about, hey, you can read all the great ideas you want, but what really matters is which of those ideas you actually implement. Yeah, which one do you implement into your daily life? And so it's one thing to have 100 ideas, but unless you're putting them into action, they're not really helping you. And I think that's really the way that I try to look at it is, yeah, if I'm reading a book or find something, an article or listening to a podcast, I try to find something. Hey, can I find one thing that I can actually implement, as opposed to 100 things that are like, oh, that sounds cool, but I never do anything with it. And sometimes that's hard to do, man. We're busy, right? And you're doing stuff, and it's hard to sometimes go and say, hey, I'm going to make this change, or I'm going to incorporate whatever it is. It's always a challenge. But I think when you're organized, it definitely makes it easier. Yeah, it makes it a lot easier. When you think back to that time at Marquette, what's a highlight? What's something that stands out to you about your time in Milwaukee with Marquette?
Well, our first year in Milwaukee at Marquette was my year one as a graduate assistant. Was Coach Williams' year five as a coach at Marquette, and so it was 12-13, and we made it to the Elite Eight. And so obviously we have not been back since, so I don't know how good of a coach I am. But but yes, that was probably the biggest highlight, was making it to the Elite Eight and the NCAA tournament. And, you know, we played against some good teams in the tournament and in the Big East, because it was kind of the old school Big East at the time. So there was a lot of big-time highlights. But the relationships I built with those guys was awesome. But when it comes to actually moments, I would probably say, you know, winning the Sweet 16 game and then playing in the Elite Eight was pretty special.
All right, following up on that, you can look at the totality of your career. Who's the best player that you guys have played against? And I'm not necessarily saying the guy who had the best pro career or whatever, but just in the game, in the moment, right there in front of you, who's the best player that you've seen play against a team that you're coaching?
That's a really good question. So I would say whether or not he turns out to be the best or not, but one of the most, like, in the moment, holy mackerel, how do you guard this guy, was probably Cam Thomas at LSU. He literally torched us, and we had zero answers for him. He was extremely good. He was only there for maybe a year or two, and I know his future is still TBD in the league, and I know he can really score, and who knows, you know, what he will do. But I tell you what, in college and what he pulled off, it was pretty amazing. I'm trying to think, you know, the 5 years at Virginia Tech, Grayson Allen was good. I remember from Duke. I'm trying to think of other Duke guys at the time. RJ Barrett was really good. He kind of had a bad game against us, but he was special at the time. We played against a lot of really good players, but at least recently, since we've been in the SEC, Cam Thomas just torched us.
Yeah, there's some guys. It's kind of funny when you think about just the level of talent and how many guys there are that are out there that are just so good. And I think people, you know, you watch on TV, and I think the average fan doesn't really have an understanding of how good these guys are. And regardless of what their pro careers turn out to be, in a lot of cases, I mean, there's guys of just fantastic college players, and the level of talent, you know it better than anybody, the depth of talent today and the skill sets that college players have. It's incredible how good players are. It's one of the things we kind of have talked about a lot here on the podcast, is just how, even going down to the youth and high school levels, just how much more skilled the players are. The number of kids that can put the ball on the floor, the number of kids that can shoot threes, whereas you go back 15 or 20 years ago, I just don't think that was the case. And I'm sure from a recruiting standpoint, being able to go out and see guys that have skill, and then you're looking for the athleticism, and then obviously then you get into some of the intangibles and things that you're looking for there when you're out on the road recruiting. But the talent level across the board is just, it's incredible. It's so high right now across the board in college basketball.
Well, and I would say, even, you know, onto your point about kind of youth basketball, and I know you guys can speak to this better than I can, but, you know, the fact that it's streamlined on social media and it's so popular, you know, I would say kids probably pick up a ball a little bit sooner, and they get into a little bit more basketball that's attractive. And I said to say, you know, the sexy part of basketball, a little bit of the over dribbling, you know, they want to do a couple different moves. So I would say this probably leans to them being a little bit more skilled with the ball at a younger age. But what's kind of funny about it kind of does, I'm going to blank on the name of the graph, but potentially, you know, you're kind of more skilled than normal kids are at a younger age. And then by the time you get to high school or college, you know, unless you're an outlier player, somebody who is good enough to play at either Division I, Division II, Division III, you at least need to be really good in one thing, whether you're an elite shooter or you're an elite rebounder, or you can really guard the ball, or you can never turn it over. And then at the college level, it's the same thing. And at the NBA level, it's the same thing. So at a young age, everybody wants to be really good at a whole bunch of stuff. And I think there are 20 to 25% of players at the college level that are really good at a whole bunch of stuff. But the other 75% just need to be elite in a few things. And then when you get to the NBA, it's even more polarized. There is 10% of the league is allowed to do whatever they want. And then 90%, 90% is literally, you better be elite in whatever that narrow, narrow lane you are in. If not, they'll just find somebody that will. And so it's weird how, like, it kind of changes as you get older. So,
yeah, I've never heard it expressed exactly in that way when you kind of think about that pipeline from youth basketball professional basketball, because you're right. When you think about youth players, and you even think about high school players, and you think about the way kids work on their game, and everybody tries to work on the things that, where I have the ball in my hands and I'm the man and I get to do what I want, right? That's what everybody's working on. And you can understand why, because obviously all those skills are things that are hopefully going to enable you to maybe do that as a high school player. But to your point, as you move up in levels, the opportunity to do that lessens. The number of guys that have the capability to do that lessens. And we talked to Mike Procopio, who was with the Mavs and
does a lot of work. And so when we had him on, he talked about just the exact same thing that you said. He's like, look, there's maybe 20 guys in the league that,
correct,
as yeah, you said, get to do whatever they want. And those are the guys that are obviously household names that everybody knows. And everybody else, you're wasting your time if you're not working on, correct, the things, yeah, that you're good at. And you just have to be like, okay, here's what I do in a game. Here's what I need to do in a game in order to stay on the floor and in order to stay in the league. And he's like, some guys figure that out early. And those are the guys who have long careers and make a niche for themselves. And then you have other guys who still maybe fancy themselves as, hey, I'm a do-it-all type of guy. And so they never really accept that, hey, this is my role or this is my niche or this is the one skill I've got to perfect. And a lot of times those guys fall out of the league because coaching staffs just don't have the time to battle with a guy to be, that's, hey, right, you've got to play your role. And so when you're talking about professional basketball, you're talking about, as you said, this guy isn't going to do what we're asking him to do. He's not Giannis. He's not LeBron. So we can find somebody else who's going to perform that role. And it's really interesting. I never heard it expressed quite that way where, as you said, during the pipeline, younger ages, everybody's working on everything. And then you get more and more specialized as you get up through the higher levels of basketball. It's an interesting way to look at it.
Well, what's also hard too, and I get it, the only reason why basketball is that popular is because of those players. But like, making it to the NBA, I mean, you almost got a better chance of making it, like winning the lottery. Like, it's extremely, yeah, hard to do. Like, it's, I mean, you all can spit percentages at me better than I can, but it is very, very hard to do. And so you're trying to aim for something, not saying it's unachievable, but it's more unachievable than it is achievable. And so it's kind of like, if I had like, and I'm not saying, here's just one scenario, but like, let's say you had a physically gifted kid at a young age that was not afraid of contact, but showed a little bit lack of coordination here and there, but loved basketball, et cetera. We almost need to do like the, hey, I need to teach my kid how to be a kicker or a punter in football. Just right, all you work on is being an elite level rebounder and catch and shoot and make a shot. And you just be stupid good at those. Who cares if you can dribble? Who cares if you can pivot? Who cares at anything? Be an elite level rebounder because you're physically, like, you doesn't bother you to bump into people, and then be able to catch, shoot, and make a shot. And you might go to college for free, at minimum a Division II somewhere. And so why try to learn how to be Kevin Durant? Like, there's no reason to. The odds of you being Kevin Durant, stupid low. So why not figure out a way to go to college for free? It's just – but there's a lot of luck involved too. Like, Anthony Davis isn't Anthony Davis if he wasn't 6 foot majority of his life and he had to be a guard. And all of a sudden, sure, he gets a growth spurt out of his ass, and now all of a sudden he's 6'11" and he's the best player in the world. So there's a lot of luck too. So it's a hard equation.
I think when you look at the highest levels of the game, right, when you're talking about NBA basketball, you're talking about guys that go and play professionally overseas, or you're talking about high-level Division I basketball – there's some physical tools that players that are playing at that level have that if you don't have those physical tools, and again, there's a variety of what those physical tools can look like. It could be size, it could be speed, it could be eye hand, there's whatever. There's a lot of different things that you could have, but the fact remains is that you better have some of those things at a pretty high level, and that's before you even factor in the basketball side of it. It's just like there's some physical characteristics that enable you to do things that other guys just can't do. They may have similar skill, but you know, I may have been able to shoot the basketball pretty well, but I couldn't jump like Rex Chapman. So my ceiling of being a basketball player was capped because I didn't have a 42-inch vertical in the way that other guys did. So it's just, you have to have those things. So
you did shoot 39% on 144 attempts your senior year.
I did shoot a little. It's funny because it's funny that you say that. And, you know, sometimes we'll get into these discussions. But what's interesting is to me, looking again as a 52-year-old guy, looking back on, you know, the way that kind of I grew up in the game, it was just a completely different. It was a completely different game. And I think about the way that we played the game back when I was in school. So I was in college from 1988 to 1992. And I think about what the type of shooter that I was, and you think, man, if I was playing college basketball in the year 2022, like how many threes would I have been firing up there in a season right now compared to what I did in the era that I played in. I think that's one of the things that, for me at least, is kind of interesting to go back. And sometimes I watch games, I'm like, man, I don't even recognize what's happening. I might have been involved offensively and defensively, Lyle, in 5 pick and rolls over 4 years as a college basketball player. And I can honestly tell you that I don't know that I ever in my career drove to the basket and threw the ball back out to the top of the key. Maybe I threw it to the corner, maybe, but I certainly never kicked the ball back out outside the 3-point line after having driven all the way to the rim. And you just look at the way the game's played, it's completely different.
It's funny you say that, and we could get down a rabbit hole on this. I want to say it was the book called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. And he talks a lot about the whole luck component, but a lot of it is like your structure. So he used an example, and I'm going to all the way butcher the example. But there was a study there for a while that like all of the NHL hockey players came out of Canada. Age.
Yeah,
that's right. Because of their age, they got the more resources. And how it was broken down, they just had the advantage. So it's funny you say that, because there are things that are out of our control that influence the outcome of our pursuit. And same with you. So like, you're an elite level shooter, but yeah, you came off the ball screen 4 times. So you could have been even better player or even worse because of the system that you grew up playing in. So it's that is one thing that I've learned, and not a lot of people give credit to, but so much of what occurs, you have no idea that what happened to you rather than what you did to get there. And it's a marriage of both, but it's unique.
Right. It's so true. I mean, you just think about, let's say on the college level, depends on which program you go to, right?
That's a
coach that fits the style of play that works for you. Or maybe it's even just as simple as a personality conflict between a coach and a player, or a good mix between coach and player. And so that's one of the things when I think about my own career, like I ended up in the right place for me at the time because my coach liked the things that I did. There were probably lots of other places I could have gone where maybe the things that I did wouldn't have been as valued. And so I think about that all the time, that, hey, I just ended up in the right circumstance and that allowed me to flourish. And there could have been other places where I didn't. And that makes you think too about guys who get drafted into a professional league, whether that's the NBA or you're talking about the NFL or Major League Baseball, whatever. So much of it depends on your situation. Now there's guys, again, you talk about the top 20, 25, 50 players in the league. Those guys are probably going to succeed no matter where they are.
Agreed.
But you look at the other 300 NBA players, and so much of that is interchangeable, that if you're not in the right situation with the right coach and the right staff and all those things, that it really does make you wonder about, hey, here's a guy who he's quote unquote, he's a bust. Well, maybe if he had just been
all the way
with a different coaching staff. Yeah. And maybe if he had, instead of getting off to a rough start and losing his confidence, maybe he got in with the right player development guy and that guy said, hey, you got to do this and that. And they hit it off. And now suddenly that guy's career takes off in a totally different direction. And so I think the general public doesn't understand, as you said, how important that structure is around players, for sure.
That and people have to recognize too on this, and I'm not saying I'm perfect with this, but typically if somebody makes it to a level and they say they climb the mountain and they are on top of the mountain, they point to themselves saying, hey, I climbed the mountain because of my work. But then if the mountain beat them and they couldn't climb the mountain, they blame it on outside circumstances. And it's not always as clean as that marriage is. Yes, there are things you could always blame. And yes, you had the energy and dedication to fight. But there's so much out of our control, almost more out of our control than in our control. It's too hard. So
I agree with you 100%.
That's a different rabbit hole, though, for sure.
No, I think you're 100% spot on. I think what's interesting is that growing up and then being a coach and experiencing it as a player and then experiencing the game as a coach, and then you get to experience the game once you have kids and your kids start going and you start looking at things. And so there's all these different perspectives. And one of the things that has struck me a lot as I've talked to parents and kind of gone through it as myself is just that how fast your athletic career goes by and is gone. And sometimes I think as a coach, it's really easy to look and say, okay, this was a quick 4-year period and now we're in year 5, or it's I've been there 10 years, or you know, this season's over, maybe it didn't go quite the way we wanted and we're moving on to next season. And when you're a player, you realize, or when you're the parent of a player, I think you realize it even more, that time goes really quick. Like you turn around and you're like all of a sudden, and I've talked to parents who have been in situations, I'm talking probably more like the high school setting, where the structure, the personality with a coach, it didn't work and for whatever reason. And then it just happened to coincide that this coach was here during this time when their kid was there. And all of a sudden you're like, man, like their high school career is over. Like it went fast, yeah. And you only get one chance at it. And I think sometimes as adults, you know, there's always, you know, we have more time, but kids and players, their time is much more limited. Like you can coach until you're 65, 70 years old. A player's career, even if they're LeBron, at some point that career is going to end. So it's, you know, it's kind of interesting. So let me ask you a question just about this. So thinking about what we've just been talking about here, one of the keys I'm assuming to recruiting is you've got to find guys. A, obviously there's a requisite level of talent and basketball skill and whatever that they need to have in order to be able to play at the level at Texas A&M where you guys are coaching in the SEC. But there's also the piece of it, I got to find guys that are going to mesh with Coach Williams. I got to find guys that he's going to be able to coach and get the most out of. So when you think about that and you're out on the road recruiting and you're watching video, you're talking to players, you're talking to high school and AAU coaches, what are some of the things that you're looking for beyond the raw ability and basketball skill that, again, it's obviously not a perfect science, but what are the things that you're looking for that make you think that a player could fit with what Coach Williams does?
So good question. So I would say that you are spot on. I would say a player for Coach Williams might be different than a player for Tony Bennett. Doesn't mean right, wrong, or different. Both are really good coaches, but whoever you are recruiting for, finding a player that fits their system is important. So identifying kind of who that person is for sure the right thing to do. I do think there's a combination. I think I heard one coach say, I forget who it was, like there's kind of hard skills and soft skills, where hard skills is like you're, you know, pass dribble and shoot, and your soft skills is a little bit of, you know, leadership, your ability to overcome, you know, a bad call, stuff like that. And so I do think there's a marriage between it all. Even to your first point, yes, you have to be skilled enough, but like, okay, let's say I find an outside dog who is physical, he's mean, he's a competitor, and he's extremely skilled. Well, there's not going to be one college in the country that doesn't want that guy. So like, you can always, like, we always talk about how our grandparents can pick out the best players in the gym. And then like the other ones, the ones after that, like, okay, they're missing, you know, they're not as developed in certain areas, or they don't really verbalize a lot on the floor, and they don't really talk a lot, and they don't really bark a lot on the floor. So are they tough enough to play for Coach Williams, or they just haven't had an opportunity to show it? And so the rest of it is, all right, we got to dig a little bit more to kind of find out if that individual is right for Coach. But I do think it depends on your current makeup of your team too. So like, let's say we have 9 guys on our team that you would pick to get into a fist fight. Like they are mean mother jammers, but none of them can shoot the ball. Well, then we probably need to take somebody that can really, really shoot, even if he has some soft tendencies, just because at the end of the day, we still got to put the ball in the hole. So I do think it depends on what you're looking for. But if you had to pick out like certain characteristics that we're always discussing, we are discussing toughness. That does not mean you need to verbalize it, but are you tough enough to play for a coach that will hold you accountable? Physical has to be one, right? They have to have the physical attributes to be able to pull it off. We're big on coachability because we are going to – Coach Williams does a great job of pushing our players to limits that they're not used to playing at. So are you willing to do that? And then fit is really important. Like, does he fit our culture? Does his family fit our culture? Do our values match as people? And so fit is a very important piece to that equation as well.
Let me dig into that coachability piece that you mentioned.
Yep.
When you're looking at that, how are you going about trying to discern whether or not this player is coachable? What are you watching for when you're watching them? And then what are the conversations like? Because I'm assuming that part of that coachability conversation has to be had with their high school coach, their AAU coach, people that are around them. So what does that process look like in terms of trying to determine a player's coachability?
Yeah, definitely a lot of Q&A for sure. And whether it's with the high school coaches, and you can get a lot of information too from other players. So we always say players know players. So even if you're chatting with them, hey man, like great game, keep it up. You got a chance to play in college, you know, maybe not this level, but you got a chance. Hey, what'd you think of John? How do you like playing with him? He'll tell you the truth. Oh, I love him. He's exactly. great teammate. Man, he's really good, but I hate playing with him. He never passes the ball. You know, he's got an attitude. So like you can like steal some real good content from other players. Because they're not trying to like throw them under the bus, or they're also not trying to overly praise them. They're just being kids and telling you the truth. So you can get a lot of good intel from them. And then I know all coaches will say this, but it's very true. And when you tell when you tell high school kids and middle school kids this, they kind of roll their eyes. But body language is significant. You know, how's your body language when you're getting yelled at? How's your body language when you turn the ball over? Or, you know, are you being a turd on the bench when you get pulled out because you got a second foul and it was 65 feet away from the rim? And again, you're not supposed to be perfect. They're still young. They're still maturing. So we understand that your maturity level at age 16 is not going to be what it's supposed to be at 22. So we know that there's areas like that, but you just got to pick up on signs, and it's all the way a moving target. And by no means do we have the equation perfectly picked, because we've gotten a lot wrong. We've gotten a lot right. And so you just try to keep your system evolving with data as it comes along.
Can you walk us through the entire process for identifying a player? In other words, getting them on your radar, where you go from you don't even know the player exists to how do they get on your radar, through the process of being evaluated, eventually getting the opportunity to be connected with Coach Williams, to the moment where they sign their letter of intent. Just what's the process that you guys go through? Is it pretty similar for every player, or is it different depending upon just, again, proximity? Just what's the process from start to finish of identifying a recruit until they sign that letter of intent?
So the one thing I will say, if there's a diverse group of listeners, is it depends on what school that you recruit from. So high major basketball compared to mid-major basketball, compared to low major basketball, compared to junior college, compared to Division III, compared to NAIA Division II. So the process for us is much, much different than the process for Division II or Division III. And so just knowing that it's tailored based on the level is important, but at least at the high major level, typically prospects that show high major potential are identified pretty early in grassroots basketballs through AAU or high school coaches. And so there's a lot of scouting services out there that put a lot of reports together and put a lot of intel. And randomly, if there's a 6'6 sophomore that either can shoot the brakes off the ball or is extremely athletic or kind of has an outlier skill set that is a significantly stronger than his peers at that age, that word usually spreads pretty fast. It's just a common thing. And so even other high school coaches know, hey, you know, number 12 at XYZ high school, he's a freshman. He is good. He's got a chance. Like that word just, it catches fire so quickly because everybody wants to be known as the person that told somebody about somebody.
right.
It usually gets to our desk somehow. So identifying the players, I would say 80% are kind of either through scouting services or you're watching grassroots basketball at the AAU level. This is all for high major basketball, or even a high school events in the summer. That's, I would say, identifying them. That's usually where it comes from. And then the other 20% are either late bloomers or guys that live kind of in rural areas that don't have the exposure. That's kind of where 20% come from, where you're at a random event or you happen to know a guy in a randomly small town that knows of a special talent that nobody knows about because they don't get exposure. So identifying it, that's more or less where it comes from. Evaluating, I would say 70%, at least at the high major level, comes at the AAU organizations, and then 30% comes from the high school teams, at least at the high major level. I would say when you drop down levels, that changes a little bit, especially Division II and Division III, probably get more from the high school level. And then getting connected, there is a lot of rules and regulations to getting connected. NCAA is heavily regulated, as it should be. So based on their age, there are certain rules and regulations on how you can contact them or how they can contact you. So the simplest thing I can say is Division I programs are not allowed to call and communicate via phone with recruits or anybody related to the recruit, which is called an IAWP, individual associated with the prospect, until June 15th of the summer. Sorry, June 15th between their sophomore and their junior year. And so there's a lot of other rules even after that date and before that date on when you can talk to them, when you can't, how to talk to them, et cetera. But that's probably your biggest clean-cut line in communication. And then from assign a letter of intent, that's the hardest part to do for all levels, is everybody recruits everybody they want. They probably have a tier on guys they have to prefer over others. How gettable is player A compared to player B? When is player B making his decision compared to player F? So like there's a lot of decision making involved, and not just decision making, but there's other schools recruiting the same kids too. So to actually get them to commit and to get them to sign the letter of intent, that's by far the hardest part. Identifying the player, semi easy to do unless they're a hybrid. Are they good enough? Are they not? But overall, they're probably good enough if you know who they are. Evaluating their talent, yes, do they fit? But that's kind of the easier part. None of it's easy, but easier part. Staying connected, if you're really good at your job and you work hard, again, you can pull that off. You can get it done. But actually getting the player to say yes to your program, especially if he's a high major or a high major plus player and you have a lot of other real dudes at other real staffs chasing the family and the kid down the same way you are, that's by far the hardest thing to do. So it's an art. It's a moving target. We can't say we have it perfect by any means. We have a system that works for us. And if you can get a kid that you really like to sign a letter of intent after a 2.5-year recruiting process, that's a big time accomplishment. For sure.
Yeah. Putting in that investment of time with a kid and getting them to sign, I'm sure is a moment of celebration in the coach's office. Let's put it that way.
Well, and a lot of kids, you know, a lot of coaching staffs will say this too. You know, you'll miss on 12 to 15 kids to every one that you get. And so, you know, rejection has to be a comfortable pattern in your life. Not that you're ever comfortable with it, but you almost have to, you know, allow it to just be, all right, that's one. Let me figure out the lessons I need to learn and move on to the next one. That's definitely a skill that has to be evolved, at least from a staff standpoint.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit CoachingPortfolioGuide.com hoopheads to learn more. All right, let's talk a little bit about that. When you think about the characteristics of what makes an outstanding, let's go without assistant coach first. What do you think, based on your experiences, the people that you've been around, and then your own experience as an assistant, what do you think make for an outstanding assistant coach? Give me maybe the top three characteristics.
So it's funny. I don't view myself as an outstanding assistant, so it's going to be hard to speak on that. However, from what I could gather, you won't be able to be a good assistant coach if you're not very good at problem solving. You need to be an elite problem solver to be an assistant coach. Now, that can be a wide variety of things. You have a kid having patterns of not showing up on time. A kid can't manage his time management. I mean, more or less, all assistant coaches have to be elite problem solvers. That has to be the number one important thing, or at least a top three thing. Another thing I would say is a skill. I don't know if this is top three, but I have noticed that assistant coaches need to be very good at following up and following through, even support staff members. So whether a head coach asks you to do something or, hey, I need you to do X, Y, Z, making sure the task is completed accurately and also following up with the head coach on that task. That's probably not a top three, but it is an underrated skill set that more people probably should adopt and adapt. And then, honestly, it's going to sound cliche, but it's true, is can the head coach trust you to do your job and to be loyal to the program? There's a lot of people in our industry, and heck, this is probably every single industry, that have selfish desires and selfish ambitions and that will say a lot of petty lies. And so I think if you can be a loyal soldier that works really hard, that could be trustworthy, that will go a long way as an assistant coach.
All right, let's take it the other way. What's something that you admire about Coach Williams as a head coach that you think have made him as successful as he's been able to be?
He's extremely good with people. He is he's very much a player's coach, so players really enjoy playing for him and the relationship they have with him. It's not necessarily a head coach to player relationship. Obviously, it is for pure basketball reasons, but it is way more of a mentor relationship. So a lot of his success has been dictated on the fact that players will play hard for him. And he's not the only coach that happens for. That happens for many coaches across the country. But the reason why he's been successful is because his guys are talented, but they also play hard for him. So none of it's possible without the belief that players have in him. So he's very much relationship-driven. And actually, from a day-to-day, he's extremely well-organized. He's by far the most well-organized person on our staff. He has his own personal calendar. It's extremely detailed. In addition to being organized, he's also extremely disciplined. We all pursue to be more disciplined in whatever that may be, whether it's our spiritual world or it's our exercise world or it's our spend time with our family world. Coach Williams is probably the best I've ever seen in my life at being disciplined to what he wants to do on a daily basis. And so, by far, I would say those three things. He has a lot of attributes, but he is extremely good with people. He is very disciplined in what he does daily, and he's very, very organized. In addition to being a visionary and a question asker, he's a very intelligent person as well.
How do you guys, as a staff, determine roles within the program? So is that something that comes from Coach Williams? Is that something that comes from a discussion of, hey, here's where I feel like I can add value, and then Coach Williams delegates certain parts of the program to each of you? Just how do you delegate roles on the staff? What does that look like?
So Coach Williams usually does identify each individual's buckets. So Coach Williams has a spreadsheet He pretty much says that everybody is a head coach of their own responsibilities, which I think is a good way of saying it. It allows ownership. It gives ownership to each of our staff members of, hey, this is what you all are the head coach of. And so we each have an understanding of our obligations to the program, our responsibilities day to day, what we need to manage. And does he determine all of those? Ultimately, he has the ultimate say. He checks the box, say, yes, I agree. But I do think there is, similar to, you know, a male-female relationship or a marriage, there's very much a discussion on, you know, how the marriage can best work. And so he talks often to our entire staff about, okay, who would be best at this? Can he manage those five things and also manage number 6 and 7? So it's definitely a discussion. But ultimately, Coach Williams does check off who's responsible for what aspect of our program.
So when you guys are on the practice floor, let's just talk about your role. During a practice, what are you doing? How do you guys divvy up the what you're watching and what you're focusing on? What's your role in a practice setting?
So everybody does it different. Like you'll go to different programs and it's only the head coach that talks, et cetera, et cetera. Technically, by the letter of the law, for the NCAA standpoint, there's only 4 individuals that are allowed to coach and teach basketball. That's your head coach and your 3 assistants. So A&M specific on our staff, we break it down a little bit football related. So our associate head coach, his name is Devin Johnson. He's a very, very gifted coach and individual. He handles all of our defense. And so everything defense related goes through Coach Johnson. He teaches it A to Z, everything. And so myself, I handle everything offensively. And so anything offensively, I work very close with TJ Ryan, who is kind of my ace in the hole from a figuring things out standpoint. Him and I work together on the offense, and we try to figure it out. And so specifically to our staff, I handle the offense, and Coach Johnson handles the defense. And there's other people on staff that support those 2 large buckets, and obviously there's special teams and there's personnel and there's other aspects to basketball. But specifically for us and what we do right now, that's kind of how it outlines a little.
So when you're putting together what you want your offense to look like, so let's say, again, go back to the end of last season, you sit down, you look through and think about, watch the film, think about what you did this past season, what's successful for you. And then you look at, okay, what do we have coming back? Obviously, you get new guys that are coming in. You've got the summer. You're working with players to help them improve on an individual basis. You're also working on team stuff as you go through your summer. Where are you right now on September 1 as far as having a handle on what you want to do offensively? Obviously, there's a core philosophy. How much you guys tweak that year in, year out? And what is it? What do the conversations look like inside the coach's office between you and Coach Williams and the rest of the staff when it comes to figuring out what are we going to do offensively?
So I do think an identity of what you want to be about as a program obviously is important, the foundation. What do you believe in, your principles, your values, your culture? And that bleeds down to what sort of identity you want to have on the court as well. And so at least at the high major level, and for sure at the mid-major and low major level, you used to be able to hold stronger to an identity on the court, but now with the transfer patterns and the new rules, you know, the makeup of your roster at the end of February can look completely different than the makeup of your roster on June 1st. And so I do think staffs have had to adapt to being a little bit more, okay, I need to see how this is going to play out and how can we best leverage the skill sets that we have on our team to win games. So we still talk as a staff on how we want to still hold on to themes and have an identity offensively and defensively so we can recruit to both of those. And I would say this past year and a half, we've done a good job of landing on an identity defensively. And this past year and a half, I've had a little bit of a searching offensively. Maybe it's because I'm not as good of a coach as I need to be on the offensive end, but we are getting more comfortable with what we want to do offensively. And a lot of it's been through trial and error. A lot of it's been, you know, the addition of 6 to 7 new faces in the spring that allow us to do certain things. And so we are closer as of September 1st, as of today, we are about 80% sure on the direction that we're headed. And then ultimately, Coach Williams does a really good job of creating structure that allows our players just to be who they are. And so a good thing is we're not going to dive into a great deal of X's and O's. We're going to try to put everybody on the same page offensively and allow our players to be players, and we give them the trust to make the right decisions is ultimately the goal. It's just how do you get the players to be on the same page without a direct play call? And so that's kind of been the discussion.
So what does that look like in practice when you talk about, okay, we have our way we want to play. We have the way we want our players to see the game, the types of actions that we want to have in there, but yet we don't want to be standing on the sideline calling a set play every time down the floor. So then what does that look like teaching the game in practice when you're on the practice floor? How do you go about making sure that the players learn the actions, the reads, the things that you're trying to get them to see without walking the ball up the floor and saying, okay, now we're going to run number one, then we're going to run number two? How do you do that? What does that look like?
I do think you have to paint the picture and what it looks like. So, are you dribble drive? Are you Calipari at Memphis or Kentucky? Like, do you have four or five guys that can always get downhill with the ball? Or are you more like a Virginia or an Iowa or even like a Lipscomb or a Furman, where you guys are a little bit more pass heavy and can shoot at more positions? And so I think having a firm identity and being able to, as a team, we are self-aware that we are very good in these things and not as good in other things. That's for sure the starting spot. And so having an unbiased lens on what you can be good at is very important. And I think you just build soft structure around that. And so whether it's ball screens or it's continuity, I do think you identify, hey guys, as we're bringing the ball in transition or as we're bringing the ball across the half court line, we're looking at certain things. And if this is our alignment, we bleed into this. If this is our alignment, we bleed into that. And then we kind of give them soft reads. And we mainly want them to understand what good basketball is in regards to ball movement, body movement, how to read the defense. And there are things that you have to break down, right? So setting an off-ball, not an on-ball screen, but an off-ball, like away from the ball screen. So like a pin down or a stagger or a fade, like reading the defense on how to play it. That's all broken down in smaller segments. But then as the ball is bringing up, how does the five and the four and the opposite wing know to stagger away? Like, when do they know that's the right time versus coming to set a drag? And so you kind of have to build a little bit of guidelines into, hey, as the ball is being dribbled across or as it's being thrown ahead, this is what you're looking to do. But we do say we never do absolutes. I think we stole this from Lenny Acuff, who's an extremely intelligent coach at Lipscomb. At Lipscomb, I apologize. And he mentioned it's never always a never, right? There's always degrees of maneuverability. And so our guys kind of understand majority of the time this is going to occur, but we want them to just be players. And it's way more about the standard of their pace than it is like the accuracy of their decision. And we're kind of big on that. We want them to know the right reads, but we can't do any sort of good offense without elite level pace.
In a practice setting, when you're going up and down, or maybe you're doing some small-sided stuff to work on the skills that you just described, to work on those reads that you just described, how do you guys balance how often you stop play to make a teaching point versus you let play continue and then maybe come back to something that you saw? I think that's one of the things that especially young coaches, I think, sometimes struggle with is, how do I teach what I want to teach and yet allow my practice to continue to flow so that the players aren't being stopped every 15 seconds and interrupted by somebody coming in and giving them a 1-minute soliloquy about what read they should have made? So how do you guys balance that?
So for us, I think it's different than the high school level. For us, we have resources, we have video, we have 12, 13 people on staff. So like we can afford to avoid an in the moment error because we have the ability to bring him in and he can sit down with our video coordinator at 2 o'clock that day and like rewatch it and understand it. At the high school level, when you can't necessarily afford to do that, I do think it boils down to, and we talk about this a lot too, like the frequency of whatever just occurred, how many times is that going to happen? So like, let's say they set the cross screen wrong or even cross screen defense. Let's talk about cross screen defense. So we used to rep the you know what out of cross screen defense. How do you have the right alignment? Do you make contact? Do you put your butt into the screener's legs and do you read which way it flows and do you roll off of them? And then we got to thinking about how often do we even guard a cross screen? And so that's something too I would say is if it's a high volume act in your offense, then it's worth the time and attention to stop and to fix it and to always make it a focal point. But if it does not occur that often, even if it was you set a fade screen at the end of a ball screen, let's say you set a ball screen in the channel and you happen to set a fade screen at the same time on the wing. If that happens in two of your plays and you have 30 plays, well, for the screener who sets the fade to know he should slip if those two are going to pre-switch, like that's going to happen one every three or four games if you call it at a high frequency at most. And so therefore, it's not worth stopping to talk about. And I would say most coaches know that, but the biggest reminder that we've had in our world is to not overcoach or overtalk. Just because we're over-teaching, it makes us feel like that we're coaching, but ultimately, you're losing reps at high volume stuff. And so that's an argument that our staff has a lot. Like Coach Williams even at one point made somebody track how we allocated our practice time. So like when it comes to like not just like what we do, like offensively, defensively drills, but like what's occurring. Is Coach Williams talking? Is it rambling? Is it teaching? Are we repping? Are we live? And we kind of did a pie chart on how are we allocating our time. And so our staff has been way more intentional about quit talking.
You're good.
And quit talking and just more reps. But I do think if it's a high volume thing, it's worth the attention at the time.
Yeah, I think that high volume piece is a good way to look at it because if it's something that you're going to see over and over again, if it's something that you want the players to be able to read and to be able to execute on the floor, then obviously you want to make sure if that's something they're going to do 20, 25, 30 times in a game, then they better be able to do that right the majority of the time. Versus it's something that, hey, we might see this once in a while. And yeah, if it doesn't go quite perfectly, it's not going to kill us as a team. So I can see where that's a huge part of it. When you guys are planning practice, what's the process for planning a practice? How do you guys sit down? Does Coach Williams come up with it on his own, run it by the staff? Do you guys sit down after the previous day's practice and talk about what you need to accomplish for the next day? What's the process look like?
So we're definitely different than probably most. It's evolved a little bit. Coach used to do it by hand, and now it's turned electronic with the staff. So like that's kind of like the spectrum on how it's evolved over the last 10 years. But it's definitely a discussion amongst everybody on staff on, you know, what do we need to retouch? We're big on let's be really, really elite at what we do. And then in the season, when it comes to the opponent, let's make sure they understand the high volume stuff. But other than that, we're not diving into them. Let's hold on to being elite at what we're good at. So I would say, especially before the season, you know, we're really big on getting 5-on-5 reps as often as we can. And we have drills that we like. We have buildups that we like. So there's definitely themes and, hey, this is how practice is going to flow because this is how coach has always done it and this is how we've been successful. And when it comes to the actual makeup of, okay, what's the first thing we do? What's the second thing we do? We usually work pretty closely as a staff and either bring it to coach's attention or vice versa. He'll say, okay, these are the things that I'm thinking we need to focus on. And we just kind of have a 30 to 40 minute discussion on it and then move on. Usually we're not introducing new drills. I mean, there might be 20% throughout the year that's new, but usually 80% holds true.
All right. So to go along with that, how long does it take your new guys to get caught up kind of on, hey, we yell out the name of this drill and everybody knows what it is that we're doing. How long until those freshmen or your new guys transfers, how long until you feel like they kind of get it?
Depends on what it is, but I would say 4 or 5 attempts, they at least know what to do. Now, whether or not they're good at it, it's a different discussion. But at least they know like how like the lines rotate and how they switch, stuff like that. And again, we also know that they're not supposed to be really good at it, you know, as a freshman either. And that's what a lot of kids don't understand is, you know, they have such a high expectation for themselves where they almost get down on themselves if they're not perfect. And we look at them and say, you know, we don't expect you to be perfect. You're not supposed to be a senior or a junior right now. You're a freshman. Like, and we always try to use the analogy with them. Like, if you right now were a high school senior and you were talking to yourself as a high school freshman, and your high school freshman told you, hey, I'm going to come in here, I'm going to be perfect, you would laugh at him because he doesn't know what he doesn't know. And so we always tell our guys, especially when they're newcomers or they're transfers, you don't know what you don't know. You're going to have mistakes. Just play through mistakes with the right level of energy and the attitude, and you'll be perfectly fine.
It's hard, though, right? Because kids, especially today with social media and just the buildup, especially at the level that you guys are at Texas A&M.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, these kids have been hearing how great they are for years and years and years, and now suddenly they're coming into an environment where they're no longer clearly the best player on the floor when they step out there. And so that's an adjustment, I'm sure. How much of your job is being a psychologist?
So it's maybe I can ask you guys that even more. I would say a lot of it's definitely generational. You know, rightfully so, there's way more focus on adolescents' mental health. I do think it's an important part of the younger generation is the ability to kind of handle the mental side of life, and adults do the same thing. You know, it's funny, we knock the younger generation for, you know, being mentally weaker, or, you know, but they're just ill-equipped to handle life the same way we are. I mean, there's still alcoholism, there's still people, you know, cheating on their spouses, there's still people mismanaging their money, there's still people that are depressed at age 30 and 40. So it's funny, it's unique just because generations change. Problems kind of always be consistent, but the younger generation just happens to be more exposed to distractions and to demands and to things a part of their life that we didn't have at our age, you know. And not to get down an even further rabbit hole, but you know, when 9/11 hit, at least I know I'm semi young, so I was in middle school. You know, adults could protect kids from certain exposures based on what they can and can't handle. Well, nowadays, I don't know if you guys have kids, but your kids are getting the information before you do.
For sure.
And so, they're not supposed to be able to mentally handle a potential bomb threat or a school shooting. Like, adults are messed up by that. Adults freak out. Like, how do I handle that? There's no way a 13-year-old girl can handle the news of a school shooting a mile from her. And so, that's all to say that what I hate about the generation now is it's almost not their fault because there's so much information that they're just ill-equipped to handle that creates this psychology demand. But it's not their fault. It's not their fault at all. It's just how social media and the access to quick information, it's a unique melting pot tornado of stuff that is very difficult to manage. And it's difficult for adults to manage too. So
there is no doubt about that. All right. We are coming up towards an hour and a half, believe it or not, Lyle. It's amazing how fast time goes. I want to wrap this up by asking you a two-part question. Part one, when you think about the next year or two, what's the biggest challenge that you have ahead of you? And then second part is, what's your biggest joy when you think about what you get to do every day? So your biggest challenge and your biggest joy.
So I'll start with my biggest joy. From a work standpoint, I get a lot of joy from the people that I work with. And I tell people that all the time. They ask, you know, what's your next steps? Are you looking to be an assistant for somebody else to diversify your resume? Do you want to be a head coach? Have you started looking? And usually I always respond with, you know, God's got a plan. Whatever happens will happen. But ultimately, I really, really, really enjoy who I work with and who I work for. And I would much rather work with people that I trust, that I like. Coach Williams is one of the best leader in my life. And so I'm not running from anything. So from joy standpoint, I enjoy working with our staff and our players, and that ultimately feeds the joy on the work standpoint. And obviously my wife brings the joy in my personal standpoint. And then the biggest challenge the next 2 years, at least from a basketball standpoint, is at the end of the day, we have to make the NCAA tournament. So we're going into year four here at A&M. We've got a really, really good team. We feel that we can make a great run on the court and into postseason. We feel that we are in a position to be a very, very good team in the SEC and the NCAA tournament over the next 2 to 3 years. And at the end of the day, it is a business. We do get paid. We are employed to win games. We don't lose track of that. We have to win. Yes, we need to help our student athletes become elite level student athletes, and we are maximizing every resource we have to help them be the best version of themselves. But at the end of the day, we have to win, and we are doing that. We are moving in the right direction. But the biggest challenge for us is to maximize the number of wins we can have over the next 2 to 3 years.
Makes complete sense. Makes complete sense. That's ultimately how you're judged, rightly or wrongly. That's the way at the Division I level, clearly, that's an important reason. Yeah, that's what it's all about. That's how you're judged, and the other things that you do and the impact that you have. Unfortunately, it goes along really well when you win, but if you lose, some of those other things, unfortunately, sometimes get lost, right?
Well, and it's not overlooked. But I mean, we have a great administration. We have a great school. They definitely recognize. And this is for all schools. They recognize how good of a staff you are and how you help your student athletes graduate, et cetera. But at the end of the day, because the demand on the sports from a TV and from a fan standpoint is so high, you have to win. So, for example, if nobody cared, well, then, yeah, you're fine. Stay losing. Be a really good mentor. Help your kids graduate. Coach basketball. Have fun. But because the demand's so high, well, that's when their jobs are in jeopardy. And so it's a double-edged sword, right? The reason why college athletes is awesome is because the demand's there. You know, if there was no demand, and I don't want to call out another sport, but let's pick a random sport that doesn't have the demand. Well, you have no idea if they're winning or losing. You have no clue because the demand's not there. And so it's good and bad, you know.
Makes sense. All right, before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can reach out to you, whether you want to share social media or email, whatever. Let us know how people can contact you. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Awesome. My email is probably the best thing. It's L as in Lyle, F as in Fred, Wolf is in my last name with no E, W-O-L-F. 10 is in the number 10@gmail.com. So LFWolf10@gmail.com. And then Twitter and Instagram, I wish I could tell you what it is. I would say it's if you just type in Lyle Wolf on Twitter, it'll all pop up, and same thing with Instagram. So either Twitter, Instagram, or email are by far the best methods of communication.
Got you. I got your Twitter right here in front of me @Lyle_Wolf. So there
beautiful.
You go.
There
and we'll
go.
Put that in the show notes as well. So again, Lyle, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on with us tonight. A lot of fun diving into what you've been able to do in your career working with Coach Williams and what you guys are going to continue to build and do there at Texas A&M. And to everyone who is a part of our audience, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.